Sometimes in life, you're forced to make some tough decisions when it comes to business. In the case of Shanti Das, she made pivots in her career when personal matters arose.
2009 was an interesting year for me. I lost a family member, my uncle, who was like a dad, more like a dad to me. And then my mom developed Alzheimer's. So I felt bad being so far away because she was in Atlanta. And I didn't want all of that, the burden of that falling on my sister, my brother. And then I developed some health issues, which I think were a result of my stress that I was dealing with. So I quit. I walked away. I was making a ton of money at the time. I had a corner office, driving a Range Rover, having a great life, what most people find it as, right? But I just quit and walked away at the end of 2009 and moved back home to Atlanta.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss turning pain into positivity, staying persistent, and the importance of speaking up. And now, episode 18 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready?
The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we speak with mental health advocate, Shanti Das. Shanti is an accomplished entertainment industry veteran, speaker, author, and philanthropist. Shanti has worked in the entertainment business for over 25 years. Her music industry career, from intern to executive vice president, includes positions at Capitol Records, LaFace Records, Columbia Records, Sony Records, Sony Urban Music, and Universal Motown, where she worked directly with some of music's top talent like Outkast, Usher, Prince, TLC, Toni Braxton, Erykah Badu, and more. An advocate for many social issues, she started several successful initiatives and events in the Atlanta area to support the local homelessness community and those in underserved areas. As a result of Shanti's community work for the past 8 years, she decided to establish her very own nonprofit, the Hip Hop Professional Foundation, Inc. The foundation is now being rebranded under the name Silence the Shame, the mental health movement that has led the way since 2016. Shanti has suffered from depression over the years and has also experienced loved ones affected with mental health disorders. The movement has received global awareness and has become a commonly used hashtag to normalize the conversation in America. Shanti's foundation curates community conversations, creates content, and broadens awareness around mental health and wellness. She recently self-published her book, Silencing My Shame. Shanti shares her journey with her own emotional health and wellness and how she turned her pain and struggles into passion to start a global movement. She was also recently named a top changemaker in the world, number 7 out of 100, by a UK publication called The Big Issue. And with that being said, I would like to welcome my good friend Shanti Das to the podcast today. How are you doing, Shanti?
I'm good.
So for those that may not be familiar with you, because you have quite a resume from entrepreneur, music exec, philanthropist, I mean everything that could be kind of imagined, give people kind of a quick overview about who you are and what you've done.
So who am I? I am a little country girl from the A, as I like to say. Grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Went to high school here. I was a public school baby, K through 12. Went to Mays High School. And then I went to college at Syracuse University. Majored in television, radio, and film. Go Cuse.
Okay.
Even though we lost in the March Madness, but it's okay. Still in my feelings over that. But so Syracuse was a great time for me. I did everything at Syracuse around entertainment because I knew I wanted to work in the music industry. So I was an on-air disc jockey at Z89. I was assistant promotions director. I wrote for a little newsletter called The Happenings. Because back then, we didn't have the internet, really, or cell phones. So I literally used to take out a pen and paper and write to record companies and ask them to send me music.
Wow.
So I started grinding in college, you know, trying to make those connections. And then I interned at Capitol Records the summer of my sophomore year back in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I got hired back for another summer after my junior year. And then 4 months out of college, when I graduated, I got my shot at LaFace Records as promotions director. And the very first record I worked with, Players Ball.
Outkast.
Yep.
Wow.
So that was pretty amazing.
Pretty legendary.
Pretty legendary. Pretty cool for the resume. Then I went on to work with Usher and Goody Mob and TLC and Toni Braxton. I mean, all of the artists. We have a mutual friend, DL Warfield. Shout out to DL. He was doing all the artwork. I was doing a lot of the promotions and marketing. So that was a really great run for me. I was there until we sold the company. And then I followed in 2000, I followed L.A. Reid to Arista Records, where he replaced Clive Davis. And I was like the senior director of marketing and got to market the Stankonia project and some other things there. Became the Bad Boy liaison, did some stuff with Puff for about a year. So that was really cool. And then moved over to Columbia Records. Donnie Einer, who was the chairman at the time, brought me in as vice president of urban marketing. And then I moved over to Sony Urban Music. And from there, I went to Universal Motown, and I was hired as executive vice president of marketing. So I kind of went from intern to EVP in like a, 20-plus year period. Right. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, not too shabby. Some classic projects there, nothing too big of a deal.
Yep. And when I forgot to mention, I got to work with Prince. I did marketing for the Musicology project when I was at Columbia.
So that's next level right there.
That was a bucket list.
To me, still, my opinion, greatest entertainer of all time.
Hands down.
I mean, unbelievable.
Arguably and noted, yes.
Like a true musician.
He was a musical genius.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people don't know that Prince could play every instrument.
Self-taught too, right?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to kind of get to how this all happened because you have a resume that crushes many. But so
no.
First, born in Atlanta.
Yes.
Which is unheard of. Because very rarely do people stay. You find people coming to Atlanta
right.
and then loving it,
right?
But it's interesting. A lot of people always make their way back if they were from here.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of talk about growing up in Atlanta, your childhood, kind of all that good stuff.
Yeah, Atlanta was special. I grew up, my mom's African-American. My dad was of Indian descent, but my father died when I was a baby. So I grew up in African-American culture. And a lot of people, it's funny, I'll talk to friends and coworkers and different people in other cities, and they're like, you still have friends from your childhood? I'm like, yeah, like I still have friends from elementary school. From I think my best friends were friendships that I made in middle school, and we just had this camaraderie and love for one another that I really can't explain even as adults now. I'll tell my age, I'm 48 but I still talk to some of those same people, and although we don't talk every day, if we needed anything, we would be there for one another. And so many people don't really have that bond amongst friends when they were growing up, as childhood friends. So that was really special. And I think Atlanta just being kind of the epicenter, if you will, from a civil rights perspective, it was really special growing up in that time because I got to not only see some of our leaders, like John Lewis and Ambassador Andrew Young, these were like my peers' parents, right? Or extended family members and friends. And so to be an African-American kid growing up and actually see your friends' parents as doctors and lawyers, and politicians, it gave me this sort of sense of pride, if you will, and just a jolt in my self-esteem, knowing that I could do anything that I wanted to do, right?
Yeah.
And that those careers were attainable, which I don't think every kid of color, had that sort of inspiration, if you will, growing up. But certainly in Atlanta, Georgia, it existed.
Yeah, and I think, too, people relate to people that look like them, that act like them.
Of course.
If you're seeing it being done, you don't know any differently. That's all there is. That's
exactly.
The norm, right?
Exactly.
So you're seeing that every day. You're seeing civil rights. You're seeing music. You're seeing culture.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Atlanta, which I can contest for, because I'm actually not from here. I've been here probably 13 years now, 14 years, but I would call Atlanta home, is honestly, everywhere I've traveled in every city, Atlanta's people are different. They're cut from a different cloth. Like it is true love here.
Yeah.
Like there is no statuses. There's no, I'm better than you. There's no VIP. There's none of this. It's people help put each other on.
Mm-hmm.
People support each other, which is very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a place, like you said, where people come back. They've had the same friends for years. Nobody kind of gets amnesia. Do you know who I am kind of thing. And what I love about it is from like the hospitality to how people embrace to the melting pot that it's become. Is that people really are looking out. They do things for other people because they want to, not because they have to.
Yeah.
And I find rare in a big city, do you kind of see that? And I mean, just look at our music scene. Artists work with each other here. Film people work with each other here. Businesses. And it's amazing that more cities don't fall. And New York has had that issue for years, right?
Yeah.
You always hear it in the scene is that New York artists don't support New York artists.
And, you know, we've had that issue. Like, I think people are human. But to your point, I think you see more people supporting than not.
100%.
In the Atlanta community. And even growing up, you know, we had the status issue within our own community a little bit. But I do think because, you know, we came from a generation where, like, the village could help raise the child. So, like, it could be your grandparents or it could be a family friend. You know, they were able to give advice and talk to the children. And I think now in this day and age, you don't see that as much. But it was just such a special time growing up in the Atlanta community in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, I think now the world has seen that documentary, Maynard, to see what Maynard Jackson was able to do from an economic standpoint, not only for people of color, but just for the city in general. It was just a special time coming up.
Yeah. So growing up here, had a lot of friends. What were you into as a kid? Was it music? Was it sports?
So it was music and sports.
Okay.
For sure. I was a Falcons fan as a little girl when we had Atlanta Fulton County Stadium.
Yeah.
And a big Braves fan. My uncle used to take me to the Braves games. And I wasn't a typical girl going to the Braves. Because, you know, a lot of kids like baseball. But, like, I was actually keeping stats at the game.
Okay.
And I was really into it from a different side. But that was a lot of fun. Going to the Hawks games at the Omni, which is now, you know, State Farm Arena. Phillips Arena before that. But I remember going in the days of the Omni when Dominique Wilkins was playing, and that was, like, really, really fun for us. And then from a music perspective, I love to dance. So me and my crew, we had a dance group.
Okay.
It was called Lady Silk.
So, you still talk to the ladies from Lady Silk?
I do.
That's amazing.
Some of them are my best friends.
Amazing.
We used to rehearse after school, and there was a guy group called JM Silk. So
okay.
The name kind of derived off of their name. But it was fun. We placed in 3 talent shows. I think we did Thurl High School. We did our own Mays High School and one in Decatur. We were great. But, you know, Atlanta has this, like, classic, some classic moves from that era in the 80s called Yeek.
Okay.
Which is a special dance. So we did that really, really, really well.
And what is that dance for those that may not understand or are not familiar with it? How would you describe it to today's moves?
It's almost like throwing your hand up in the air.
Okay.
And then, I don't know. I can't really describe
Atlanta,
it.
Atlanta does have, like,
if you Google Yeek, though, I think it's been enough stories on it now where
okay.
You can understand what
a lot
it
of
is.
Dance moves have come out of Atlanta. That's why I asked.
Gosh, we were at the forefront of
everything.
Dance music and culture.
Yeah.
Even back then. And for us it was interesting because, you know, we listened to a lot of booty shake music, as they called it back then. And Atlanta's music, as you know, has evolved.
Yeah.
So Southern hip hop wasn't really a thing when we were first growing up, when I was really young in the 70s. And, you know, we listened to a lot of New York hip hop and a lot of West Coast music. So it was really interesting that I got a chance to kind of work with one of the founders of the Southern hip hop scene, being Outkast, because they really put the South on the map. I think it was the first time we got to hear, you know, someone from our town talking about streets that we grew up on or that played on. Because otherwise we were rocking New York Yankees hats, right? Or
yeah.
LA Dodgers hats before that. And then Big Boy and Dre started wearing the Atlanta Braves caps and, you know, Falcons paraphernalia. And we got to rep our own city. So that, again, gave us a real sense of pride. But music was everything to me. I listened to V103. And even before that, there was a station, WAOK, on AM, you know, on the AM dial where we got all of our music from. And I literally would come home after school every day and record on a cassette.
Wow.
Like, yeah, the little hip-hop show that they had and all the club scenes and stuff. So I've been into music since I was little.
At this point, did you know this is what you wanted your life to be?
I knew I wanted to do something in music. So
okay.
A friend of our family was the program director at V103 here in Atlanta. And he let me come up to the station and would kind of help arrange some of the music carts. And then he got me tickets to see Anita Baker and Luther Vandross. So I went backstage and I wasn't really caught up with, like, the artists. I wasn't starstruck, if
yeah.
you will. I was more fascinated with the people that were behind the artists. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, I want to be one of those people, like, making it happen for the artists and musicians. So that's when I knew I wanted to either be in radio or work behind the scenes, you know, for a record company.
Okay. So that's your first experience of seeing the
yeah,
industry
as a whole?
Yeah,
that was like 8th or 9th grade.
Okay. So now you have that experience. And now what's kind of next for you?
Just trying to network and
okay.
figure out how to make it happen.
Okay.
And
how did you do that? Because the number one thing, I'm sure you get this question more than a lot
mm-hmm.
of people, Everybody wants to be in the sexy industries.
Of course.
TV, music, all these things. I always say it's not as sexy as it is as it looks on the outside.
Right.
But everybody says, I can't get a chance. Nobody will give me an opportunity. Mm-hmm. I can't break in. But what you said was, I'm going to hustle. There wasn't like a question. Somebody like you had a very clear goal.
Yep.
And you were not going to let anybody stop you.
Not at all.
And also at a time, by the way, when in the music industry, there wasn't a lot of women either, mm-hmm. right? In leadership roles or certain executive roles. So now you're sitting here going, I'm a young girl from Atlanta. I'm going to dominate this industry. What gave you that drive? What was kind of your mind thought?
Well, one, I was not that little girl that was afraid to go up and talk to people. I would go up and talk to a stranger and strike up a conversation. And I just would try to wait to the right time. But so I surrounded myself with, you know, older people, quote unquote, at the time, right? With me being a teenager, I hung out with my sister and some of her friends. And I knew that, you know, if you could meet someone and they showed interest, then maybe they could possibly help you. So I just tried to create a lot of those relationships and learned about networking even when I was in high school, but especially when I got to college, because the late 80s, early 90s was, you know, when the music industry was really starting to take off. And so you found a lot of music industry conventions, similar to like a South by Southwest right now.
Yeah.
But back then you had everything from New Music Seminar to the Gavin Seminar to Jack the Rapper right here in Atlanta, where you had record companies coming here doing showcases and doing seminars and so forth. And so I remember sneaking into my first Jack the Rapper with Jermaine Dupri. It's funny, I met Jermaine Dupri when I was in high school.
Okay.
Before he was quote unquote Jermaine Dupri.
Okay.
But he had been on tour with Houdini, but a lot of people still didn't know him yet. And this was like right before Criss Cross.
There was no Criss Cross yet, right?
Yeah. So I sometimes used to take Criss Cross to the studio, literally. So I met Jermaine and expressed interest in what I was trying to do. And his dad, shout out to Michael Malden, helped us get into our first Jack the Rapper. And so I knew that if I could start either being around that space or asserting myself more, that I could get into these rooms and hopefully get somebody to take me serious. I remember going up to Russell Simmons at the time. This is prior to all the accusations and so forth, because he did have a good run in the entertainment industry. And I went up to him and I said, you know, I'm going to be in this industry and you're going to know me by the end of this conference. And so I just started going up to executives, you know, throughout the entire conference asking, and I would go to every panel and I would ask questions. You know, most people go to a lot of those events and they're afraid to like step up and ask questions, but I was never that kid that was afraid to ask questions. And that's how you get noticed. And people are like, wow, you know, you're a young person already thinking about this kind of stuff. Maybe you have some good ideas for the future of the business. And sure enough, by the end of the conference, you know, he came up to me. He's like, wow, I see you doing your thing, really getting out here, you know, meeting people and networking. He's like, keep it up. It's going to pay off.
So how many times, and that's a perfect example, right? People do not realize that people are watching them.
Correct.
Right? So you need to treat everything as if it's
good or bad.
Good or bad, right? Yep. It's like, you got to go hard no matter what.
Yep.
Assume everyone's always watching.
Yeah.
And I also thought what was interesting is that, you know, a common thing that I see with a lot of successful people that have come in here, whatever right that they're looking, is that that fear indicator mm-hmm. is not an option for them, right? Mm-hmm. So you said, I don't have fear, or I wasn't really scared of losing. Do you think that's something that's instilled, that you learn? Where did that develop from?
I think it's a little bit of both. Sometimes it can be inherent with people, just depending on, you know, who your mom and dad are, how successful they are, were rather, and if it's in your genes. But I think it's a learned behavior. I think I was just so hungry and I was so excited about working in entertainment that I just had to figure out way to go. I had to turn those no's into yeses, right? And I just, you know, I don't know where it really came from. I think part of it too is just me waking up encouraging myself. You know, it was difficult in college trying to keep up with the grades and also having a social life and then trying to figure out what my career was. But I think I had decided early on as a college student that, yes, it's important to have the college experience, but, you know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. So I had to take out a student loan. My mom had to take out student loans. So I couldn't mess up, you know, being in school. And so I was determined to make a way for myself. There was even an opportunity for me to do something big socially, and I decided not to go that route. And because I was like, you know, there's an opportunity for me to do something at this music conference, I think I'm going to choose this instead. So I was just always very focused and determined, you know, to make it in the music industry.
Now, you ended up going to Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a reason? Was it their program? What made you go from Atlanta to
you
Syracuse?
You really want to know what?
I'm really curious, yeah. Because to go from Atlanta to New York, upstate New York.
Is insane. A lot of people are like, why'd you go that far? And, you know, I didn't know anybody in New York. And that's upstate New York.
That's upstate.
That's not like Manhattan, right? Yes, it's freezing. And back then, it was really snowing a lot. I just like their basketball team.
Really?
I'm into basketball.
Okay.
And so I remember watching March Madness one year. I think it was my sophomore year in high school. And they were playing like Illinois or something. It was a big game. And I was like, this team is good. And I was like, let me look into the school. So after I watched their that game, I started doing my research and I found out they had a communications program and the Newhouse School was a really popular school for radio. Not necessarily for the music industry, but at that time I knew even if I did something in radio, I could probably pivot over into the entertainment industry. And that's how I got interested. And then I got accepted into a summer program that I went to the summer before my senior year in high school. So I actually got to go up and visit the campus. And after that, I was like, oh, I'm hooked. I'm coming. Because it was just something different for me.
Yeah.
And I look at college as a microcosm of the real world. And having grown up in African-American culture and going to school with just, you know, Black American kids, I knew that I needed to know how to interact with other individuals from various backgrounds. And of course, the job market was going to be different and I needed something more diverse. So I kind of used that opportunity to help prepare me for the real world.
I mean, you're in college at this point. At some points of this, you're in high school getting ready for college.
Mm-hmm.
You speak about it now with such maturity, but where were you developing such like a clear vision from?
I don't know.
Because most kids at that point, I want to party. I don't really care.
I hung out. See, this is the thing. We partied in high school.
Yeah.
I mean, we partied in high school. And, you know, again, like I mentioned, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. But some of my kids' parents were pretty well off. And we would just go out and hang out at their house and spend the night, you know, in our version of wilding out, if you will, at the house. But we weren't like out drinking and driving, being reckless. We would just kind of post up at someone's home, you know, and wild out, if you will. So like, and I even went to like, you know, I did the whole kind of Black college experience, going to like parties at Morehouse and Spelman, and going to their homecoming and FAMU when I was in high school. I did the college experience, honestly, when I was in high school. So by the time I got to college, I was like, I did that.
Yeah.
And it was cool and it was great, but I didn't overdo it. And I didn't let it throw me off my game either.
Yeah.
We partied hard, but we also worked hard and we knew that our grades mattered first and that none of us wanted to be embarrassed by failing out of school, you know, for partying. So we had a really great balance. And I hate to use the word balance because it's hard to have balance in life. You just have to, like someone said, you know, you have to go through the rhythms of life, if you will, because there's never really a complete balance.
Yeah.
So we bobbed and weaved and did what we had to do to have a fun time, but to still be a great student.
Yeah. You know what I find interesting, and this kind of speaks to what you're saying about Atlanta, right, and camaraderie and kind of the community and how you were kind of, everybody came up together.
Mm-hmm.
You never said I in any of those things, which I found interesting. It was we.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like your friends, your family, the community, you all succeeded together. You all failed together, which is super interesting versus I. I never really heard you kind of make it individual.
Yeah. I mean, our friends are special, you know, and we uplifted each other. And the difference is if we saw one another doing something that we didn't agree with, we weren't afraid to talk about it or, you know, pull each other's coattails and be like, you good? Or you sure you want to do this or that? So sometimes I think people get afraid, too, that they're invading somebody's space and privacy nowadays. If you see them, you know, going astray or doing something that you're not sure about. But you got to be open and honest. And if they're really your friends and your family members, you got to take that ride together.
And I mean, we'll jump into this later in the conversation. I mean, one of your things that you focused on right now are mental health and philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
And you see more and more people not speaking up sometimes.
Yeah.
And what is the reason that you think like your friends in those situations were comfortable with telling you this is not a good idea or this is a great idea? What is preventing kids now? Do you think it's social media? Do you think it's the additional judgment?
I think it's all of that. It's definitely additional judgment. Social media for sure. Everybody is looking at one another's feed, you know, which I like to call the highlight reel, but they're only putting the good times up. Nobody's, you know, typically you don't see anyone putting up, I had a bad day. Although some people you do, but for the most part, it's a kind of, you know, glorification of what you've been able to do. You're stunning, you know, for lack of a better term, and trying to keep up with the Joneses. And a lot of kids, they don't, you know, they don't want to feel ashamed or embarrassed or not feel like they're not putting their best out there for everybody to see.
Yeah.
So
definitely, I mean, it sounds like foundation is key.
And we
right?
didn't have any of that, right?
Yeah.
We didn't even have cell phones. So
true.
We weren't going through life every 5 minutes at a party or at an event trying to get the right angle or
checking
trying
your status.
Or like on your stories. I see people on their Insta stories or Snapchat 24/7, and it's like you're missing out. You're losing the moment.
Yeah.
Like for me, even now when I go on vacation, you know, I try not to. I still post, but
yeah.
I stopped posting every single thing in every single city and every single moment because
yeah.
I felt like I was losing the experience of being away on vacation.
Yeah, no, I think that's valid. So now you go to Syracuse, you're studying in their communication school,
mm-hmm.
debating, is it going to be industry? Is it going to be radio? Kind of where you're going to go?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of happens? Now you have an internship, right?
Internship. But let me just tell you, I first did not get into Newhouse.
Okay.
So I was only accepted into VPA for whatever reason. And I was a good student. I was a solid B+ student.
Okay.
I was not an A student. And I didn't test that well on standardized tests. So I did not get, I got accepted into the School of Visual and Performing Arts, but I did my research and I knew that I could possibly, if I, you know, did well my first year, kept my grades up, that I could apply for getting into Newhouse my second year. So I did just that. I went to Syracuse. I studied hard my freshman year. I took the test and I got into Newhouse.
So
that's a lesson too for people, because sometimes if you try, even if it's a job opportunity or something, you may not get the position that you want initially. That's not to say you can't get to that point.
Yeah.
Depending on how bad you want it. I wanted to be in Newhouse. So I busted my butt my first year, partied a little bit, but I was like, my goal is to get into Newhouse.
You know, and I think that's a valid point. I think a lot of people focus on the problem, not the solution.
Correct.
And you're the complete opposite, right? You're like, okay, well, that's great, but now how am I going to pivot and
right.
kind of make this happen?
Let's figure it out. It's got to be a way.
I love it. So now you get into the program. It sounds like after 1 year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now you're in the program. What is your first thought as you're now into this dream program that you were hoping to get into, right? Because you put a year worth of hard work to get here.
Yeah, sure. It was exciting for me. I started taking some radio classes and some film classes, and we did a lot of projects. That's when I got involved in the radio station on campus, because I thought if I'm taking, you know, some of the classes, it'd be nice to have some hands-on experience, right? Being at a being within a radio station setting. And then I started gaining some mentors in the radio space as well that had previously graduated from the program. I don't think a lot of college graduates or students realize the power of the alumni network. So I ended up getting a scholarship of a gentleman that graduated from Newhouse that went on to work in radio. And I got his scholarship for 2 years, and he started helping me while I was there kind of navigate that space.
Wow. So, you know, you got the radio station opportunity, mm-hmm. you're getting all these networking opportunities.
Yep.
What I find interesting is that most people, especially in college, say, well, I don't have enough experience yet. I can't get that.
Mm-hmm.
They won't look at me. They won't entertain it. But you don't ask. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Right.
And it seems like that throughout your career and your history up until this point was never even like a thought in my mind, like, well, I'm not ready or this. You're like, I'm going to get my foot in the door,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll focus on the next thing. You're always thinking very like, okay, what's the next move? Not, you know, trying to do too much too soon.
Exactly. And don't get me wrong. I did have my days of self-doubt, right? I think we all go through that, or the fear creeps in a little bit. But I mean, thankfully, I just didn't let that fear and doubt consume me. I just kept going, you know.
How did you stop it?
How did I stop what?
The fear and the doubt.
Gosh, I mean, you know, I'm a spiritual person. I actually grew up Catholic, so I went to church while I was in school.
Okay.
Like, kids don't still go to church or, you know, practice any kind of spiritual rituals. Not everyone, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, some people, you know, slack off, if you will, when they get to college. But for me, I kept that faith component as a big part of my life. And, you know, I talked to my sister, who's a big source of encouragement for me, because she had kind of done it before me. And so I just, you know, kept positive people around me. I stayed away from the BS in college, a lot of the negativity, a lot of the haters. And there were times where I felt uncomfortable being at Syracuse because, and not to get into diversity, if you will, but Syracuse was a diverse school. We had a large number of African Americans and Dominican students there. But there were a lot of, you know, European Americans, a lot of people from the Jewish community. And because I didn't have a lot of money, you know, I couldn't vacation and go skiing, you know, and hang out with a lot of the students that were in Newhouse. So that became a little bit difficult for me. But it didn't make me angry. it made me sad at times because I felt like I wasn't often included in some of the stuff. And when we had to have group projects, I would just end up being in the group that was the last group, you know, to be picked or whatever. It just gave me the ambition to want more. Yeah. I was like, you know what? F this. I'm going to get a good job. I'm going to make my money and I'll make my way in life and society. So I didn't let that get me down either.
Yeah.
So I think it was just staying determined, staying positive, keeping the faith component in my life and knowing that how much my family, you know, went through to get me to that point. Yeah. I didn't want to disappoint them. You know, my mom having to take out loans, my brother helping out, my sister helping out. I was like, I can't let them down.
Yeah.
You know, and so I just use that as fuel to the fire.
So people just need to kind of dig deep and find out whatever that thing is for them,
like,
right?
What it is for you, what it is in your path. You know, if your mom is sacrificed, if your dad is sacrificed, if even if you have, you know, if you came from money and you want to make your own money. You know, a lot of kids who have the good fortune of having financial freedom and success, you know, they get to a point too where they don't want to be, you know, relying on their parents' money for the rest of their lives. So that can give you, you know, fuel to want to go and do more and to make a lane for yourself. Yeah. Everybody has their own path that they come from. And I'm not, you know, negating anyone's past or their future and where they come from, but it's about the life you see for yourself and how determined and focused you can be. And of course, in this day and age, there are more distractions than there were when I was growing up.
Yeah.
But you got to stay centered and focus on your own goals.
Nice. So now you're in the program. First year, you're in it. You're loving it. You get this opportunity at the radio station. You end up meeting an alumni who becomes a mentor and grants you a scholarship. Where do you go from there?
Oh, gosh. Just, again, same thing. Staying busy on campus. Like I mentioned, I wrote for a newsletter called The Happenings. Sometimes artists would come to Syracuse to do interviews, and I would try to make sure that I could get some drops for our station. I remember going to it was in Washington, D.C. I took a trip down with a friend for this hip-hop conference called the Cultural Initiative, and Tupac was there.
Wow.
And this was when Pac was on tour with Digital Underground.
So okay.
Kind of before
Death Row and all that.
Yeah, before he became really big, but he was still Tupac. And I remember going up to him at a conference saying, hey, I go to Syracuse. I got this radio show. I need a drop from you. So just trying to like capture all those type of moments and traveling and being involved on campus as much as I could. And once I got that interview, so this is funny. Remember I told you I got not an interview, an internship with Capitol Records.
Mm-hmm.
So it was through networking. Family friend, the guy that I talked to at V103 who got me those tickets to Anita Baker and Luther Vandross, he introduced me to a young lady that worked with him named Dee Dee Hibbler who worked at Capitol Records, and she was going on maternity leave. And so she needed someone to replace her for that summer. That's how she told me about the opportunity for the summer internship with them. But I applied to the Arsenio Hall show, which was a really big nighttime talk show during the 90s. And they were on fire at that time. All the big artists were going on Arsenio Hall show. So guess what? I got the internship, but it was in Los Angeles. My mom was like, you're not going to LA. We don't have enough money. So like my little dreams were crushed. I could not believe it. So I had to eat crow and call the young lady back from Capitol. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to be taking that internship now to the Arsenio Hall show. Do you think I can still come to Capitol? So that's kind of how it worked out for me. So,
wow.
Yeah. So I just kept, you know, reaching out to people. There were a lot of letters that I sent to record companies and they didn't respond, obviously, but I didn't let it stop me. I mean, I literally wrote to all the different executives that I knew at the major companies saying, hey, I'm going to be coming up on graduation. I want to see if your company had anything. Like, you got to pound the pavement.
Yeah.
And the same thing holds true for today. I mean, now you have more resources like LinkedIn and different ways you can reach out to people, you know, in addition to like talking to them in person and so forth. But I just did everything I could to stay active and involved within the music community at Syracuse as well as outside of campus.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is that a lot of people think if it's not a particular thing that they can't do it. It seemed like you were staying busy. Any area of the business, like whether it was going to lead to anything or not,
music,
you were engulfed in it.
Yeah, writing for the newsletter, working at the radio station. I knew there were touch points that would connect us. And like friends from Syracuse, you know, they'll see me today and they'll go, I always knew you were going to do something in music because you were always, you know, immersed in that culture on campus.
Well, so now your internship you do. what's the first job that then leads from that internship you end up going, and is it LaFace?
Yes. So I did the internship for 2 summers.
Okay.
And the gentleman that hired me, his name was Keith Fry. He was a vice president of promotions. After he stopped working for Capital, he started consulting for LaFace Records. And I remember him calling me saying, and this was right after I had graduated, because I came back home. This is the other thing, too, that's important to add. You know, a lot of people get discouraged if you don't get a job right out of college. There wasn't a quote unquote job for me day one after graduation, but I ended up taking another internship, this time with Sony Music in Atlanta. It was free, but it was an opportunity to work on the retail side, which is something I hadn't learned. And I said, well, it's free, but at least I'm still working.
Yeah.
And it gives me an opportunity to network. Something's bound to come out of it. So sometimes you have to take those either smaller jobs or things that you don't think is the right thing for you, but maybe it's getting your foot in the door and use it as an opportunity, you know, to take that next step and to meet people and hopefully apply for something that you're more interested in. So sometimes it's just getting your foot in the door.
Yeah, I think people, they want to have all the glamour right out the gate.
Yeah, and it's especially this generation.
This generation, for real. But if you want to get into something,
get
it's like...
Get your foot in the door.
I remember, so I was in the music business long, long, long past life ago. And I remember I bugged a dude for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
I took out his trash. I did anything I could just to be in there with no money to see it. And eventually, I had an opportunity. But most people just don't want to put in the work in that front.
Not
and if it's your
all.
Dream job, it's called a dream for a reason.
Right.
You got to work hard to get it.
Yes.
So a lot of these kids, do you recommend? And I don't even think it's just younger people. I think older, whatever. If you want to do something, like I forget who it was that's on the NFL. He wanted to be like, I think one of the ex-Giants wanted to be like a stockbroker.
Mm-hmm.
So he literally interned at Goldman Sachs or one of these companies.
Impressive.
You know, and apparently it's so rare that you see these things that you're going to stand out if you do some of these initiatives.
Of course. And you get in there and you do the work. You do it like you're getting paid $30,000 a year. Like, I didn't take that job as if I wasn't making anything.
Yeah.
I wanted to make an impact on them.
Yeah. And it's, you know, most people that have come on the podcast, they all say the same thing, which is what you just said. Just do the work.
Just do the work.
It's not that complicated.
It's not. And 9 times out of 10, you know, if you cross all your T's and dot your I's, you're going to make a good impression on someone. But if you do the work and mind your business, that's the other thing too. I think a lot of people start off in situations and they're so green and they're excited to be down. And you just don't know how to have restraint sometimes in some of these situations, especially working in music.
Yeah.
It's understandable that you're going to come across celebrities or people that you admire, but you got to treat them like they are. They're normal, regular people.
Yeah.
So that was the other thing I did too, is I always tried to not fan out all the time and make sure that I was carrying myself in a respectful manner. But I got those opportunities and I just tried to take each job as if it was like my last and do the best that I could.
So you did, this was your second internship now at Sony.
Mm-hmm.
And then where do you go from there?
That was my first one at Sony.
First one at Sony, but second internship in total.
Correct. And
okay.
So the gentleman, that's right, we were talking about Keith Fry. So he started consulting at LaFace Records, and LA and Babyface asked him to help staff up with some folks, and especially on the promotion side, because that's what he did. I remember he called me and he said, hey, there's this, you know, I've heard L.A. Reid and Babyface. I'm like, yeah, because I think TLC was already out at the time with Ooh on the TLC tip. And so he said, well, they have a new company or they're trying to grow their company and they have this position as promotions director. Would you be interested? I was like, well, I don't know what a promotions director is, but hell yeah. Yes, I wanted, you know, take a shot. So he got me an interview with the general manager, this guy named Scott Folks, and then I interviewed with L.A. Reid. This is funny. I have to tell you a story. While I was at Syracuse, I went to visit a friend who was in D.C. doing a summer program there. And at this time, I was interning at Capitol Records. Capitol and LaFace was actually in the same building, ironically. This is when they were located in Norcross, Georgia. So I'm at this concert in D.C., and it was called the Budweiser Superfest, which was a really big brand back in the late 80s and early 90s for R&B talent. I'm at the airport. I think we were at Reagan International Airport. So I'm short, waiting for my bag to go around the carousel. And I saw my bag, but I couldn't get to it. You know, I had so many bags.
Yeah,
and
they stack up.
Exactly. It was all the way on top. So it went around one time. And so by the second time it came around, I saw this guy, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, hey, can you get my bags for me? And he kind of looked at me and turned around. He didn't get it. So he let it go around. Third time it comes back around, I'm like, dude, can you get my bags? So he looked at me like, okay. And he got my bags. So then I take my bag. I go to use the payphone because, again, pre-cell phones. I call my girl. I'm like, hey, I got my bags. I'm here. Do you want me to take a taxi to come meet you? Next thing I know, this gentleman comes around the corner. It looks like a scene from a movie. He has, like, five sky caps and all these, like, Louis Vuitton luggage. And I was like, who is this guy? And so he walks down a little bit, and then he looks back at me. It was L.A. Reid. So when I did the interview, he remembered me.
He remembered.
And he actually saw me in the hallway one day at work, and I was so embarrassed. I was mortified. I was like, oh, my God, I asked L.A. Reid to get my luggage. But he joked about it. You know, to this day, he still jokes about that story.
Because
he was like, you weren't afraid to ask me for your luggage. He was like, I don't even get my own luggage. But he was like, this young lady must be, you know, pretty ambitious and a hard worker.
Yeah.
And so it kind of paid off.
Wow, that's
just
wild.
A funny story.
That's crazy.
So anyway, I ended up interviewing with LA and Scott, and that's how I got hired. Because they said they just needed somebody to help them build their promotions team, mm-hmm. which essentially was me taking 12 inches to clubs, whether it was regular clubs, strip clubs, you know, and promoting our artists from a grassroots perspective.
So in this new promotions role that you're learning as you go, mm-hmm. kind of what was that job like?
Again, it was, I was in the office during the day. I would have to work with, you know, DL and that team to make postcards and any kind of merchandise, t-shirts and tchotchkes to distribute, like hand-to-hand distribution. That was really big from a street team perspective. And we had a parent company, Arista Records, and our street team in various markets was pulled together through Arista. So I worked closely with them, providing them with all the merch and promotional product that they needed. I would tour. So going into, oh my gosh, being on the road with Outkast was amazing, but it was difficult for us early on because it was kind of a new sound. So especially like New York and certain markets, they weren't that open to the sound. They thought we were country. They couldn't really understand it. But markets like Dallas and San Francisco were like early supporters of the Outkast scene. So we went to conventions. We performed at Holes in the Wall, like all of these clubs. Being on the road with Usher. On his first promo tour, I think we did every little hole in the wall imaginable. But I would have to go and advance the show and make sure the mics were ready and make sure we had promotional product to distribute. I also got to work with Toni Braxton that first year that I started at LaFace. She was on tour with Frankie Beverly and Maze. And so I would set up meet and greets at the venues, so big venues. I would have to go and find a room to do the meet and greet and then bring all the radio programmers and contest winners back to meet Toni. So I kind of helped facilitate all that.
Very cool. So you work with, honestly, between the LAs, the Babyfaces, these artists like Outkast, Prince, mm-hmm. Usher. I mean, these are people that are not just successful. They're literally game changers in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Did you notice certain commonalities in them that made them successful? Was there something that you saw in each of these folks you're like, from whether it be Toni or whoever, saying, all right, I'm seeing a lot of the same stuff that's driving these people.
Like L.A., Outkast, you know, Andre and Big, Usher, it was their level of professionalism and their commitment to their craft. I was like, they are game changers. Like, they work hard, they super creative, and, you know, I've never seen anybody rehearse as much as Usher. Like, this guy went balls to the wall. And even, you know, being willing to go and do all of these shows. Because, you know, sometimes it's tough. You're in a small market. Even before you get to be a big superstar and you go and the club is half packed. You know, it's tough to still go out there and present your music that you've been, you know, sweating over and producing for so long. And you want to put your best foot forward. But it's tough being able to break that music sometimes in some of the markets. And just their level of professionalism and willingness and their desire to make their dreams come true. I was like, if they're going to work that hard, then I'm going to work that hard to help them make their dreams a reality.
Well, so there is no plan B for these folks.
It didn't seem like. No, yeah. They were totally committed. And, you know, and LA was like, he would go from the office to, you know, some staff dinners or meetings, then to the studio. And, you know, we were all right there together. And then I go to the clubs after that. So sometimes I work like 18, 20 hour days.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that that's the best thing for someone to do from a self-care perspective. But, you know, I was younger. I could handle it back then. I certainly couldn't handle those type of hours right now. But, you know, back then I was committed to my craft. And being a young woman in hip hop, too, there were some obstacles for me. You know, I had to sometimes face, you know, men trying to hit on me and that sort of thing. But I stood my ground. And I always tried to carry myself in a respectful manner so I didn't have to deal with a lot of the BS.
Yeah. So in your role now, you're handling promotions. And then you kind of evolve over the next few years into different titles, different companies. So mm-hmm. where do you go from there?
So while I was at LaFace, I think probably around 1996, between 96 and 97, I was getting a little burnt out on the promotions tip. Tired of being in the clubs and doing that thing. And in promotions, so it's a little bit different when you're working at a boutique label. Radio promotions, you really need a full staff. And so the people at Arista was like, well, do you want to come work for Arista? And then you could become a regional promotions manager. But I don't think LA and the others really wanted me to leave the company at the time. So I pivoted over into marketing. And one of my good friends, Lisa Cambridge, and Sherry Riley, you know, talked to me about doing marketing. And so I moved over, started doing marketing. And that's when I did marketing for Outkast and Donnell Jones and like the TLC Fan Mail album I got to do marketing on. So that was nice to transition over into marketing. Then when they sold the company in 2000, that's when I followed L.A. Reid up to New York, because it was a little devastating for me because I had just bought a house in Atlanta and, you know, excuse me, things were going great. And I was happy for them, you know, and their success. But then I was like, shoot, I got to figure out what's next, because there weren't a lot of record companies based in the Atlanta area.
Yeah.
So I had to either decide to go to L.A. or New York. And that's when I decided to go to New York.
And then, so now in New York, first time living there?
First time, well, outside of, yeah. you know, Syracuse.
So yeah. what was your, that's quite a change, Atlanta
it
to
is.
New York.
And honestly, I didn't get a home or an apartment in Manhattan. I moved to Jersey.
Okay.
Because I still wanted to drive to the grocery store and drive to Target. Like that. I was like, I'm not ready to take the subway to get my cleaners.
yeah.
But it was still culture shock for me. Just New York is more fast paced and, you know, not really that Southern friendliness that you have. And just the lifestyle was different. You know, that old saying, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And that's true.
Yeah.
You know, New York is a tough place to live. But if you can get there and be successful, I think it's a lot of positives that you can take out of it.
And how long were you in New York for?
Almost 10 years.
Wow.
Like 9.5 years and some change.
So during that time, still in the music business.
Music business, loving it. Yeah. I enjoyed it. That from being in New York, I went from senior director of marketing to executive vice president, which was a pretty big title
yeah.
for a woman in music, and especially in marketing. There weren't a lot of people that were executive vice presidents at the time. So I was excited to kind of be at the forefront of that. But, you know, that's when, you know, I started going through some challenges, too, just being away from home. You know, I didn't really have a full support system there. Started dealing with a lot of politics in the workplace, because you're talking about working at larger corporations and politics was heavy and thick.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So trying to navigate through that. So there were some ups and downs in New York, but I still made it through. And for the most part, really enjoyed the experience. But by the time 2009 came around, I could see a shift in my attitude. I was depressed in some ways and didn't know what to call it. And it was time to come home.
And then at that point, you kind of, you know, felt it was time to make the move out.
I did. 2009 was a interesting year for me. I lost a family member, my uncle, who was like a dad, more like a dad to me. And then my mom developed Alzheimer's. So I felt bad being so far away because she was in Atlanta. And I didn't want all of that, the burden of that falling on my sister, my brother. And then I developed some health issues, which I think were a result of my stress that I was dealing with. So I quit. I walked away. I was making a ton of money at the time. I had a corner office, driving a Range Rover, having a great life, what most people would define it as, right? But I just quit and walked away at the end of 2009 and moved back home to Atlanta.
It seems like stress is...
Not to another job. I just left and
just
walked
left.
Away for a while.
And so when you left, right, obviously you're already dealing with a lot with family that you have to process, but now also a transition from a 20-year career to yeah. doing something every day to no longer.
No longer. And I had a nest egg. You know, I'd save some money. I sold my home in Jersey, so I made some money from that too. But, you know, that nest egg is not going to be there forever.
Yeah.
So I started doing some light consulting, dealing with more like R&B projects that needed independent marketing. So I did that a little bit and started doing some event planning, some celebrity procurement, that sort of thing. But I also started doing a lot of community service work. And I couldn't really figure out why I wanted to start doing so much more community work. I'm like, where is this coming from? And I just started incorporating that more and more into my life. And, you know, when you're an entrepreneur, particularly on the consulting side, you can have good months and bad months. So I would get clients and projects, you know, for a 3 or 4 month period. And then, so the money, you know, there were ebbs and flows of the money. And soon that nest egg started going away. And that's one thing that I would tell anyone who's going through a transition. If you're trying to transition out from one job to another or from one lifestyle to another, you know, don't go into that transition trying to keep up with the same lifestyle that you once had. Because I probably should have lived below my means instead of trying to keep the same lifestyle that I had when I was making all that money, and I would have been able to save more. But it was just a tough transition over the last few years. And I mean, I've been home now almost 10 years. So the first 5 years were okay. But the last 5 years have been really, really difficult. And that's when I started experiencing some of my emotional health challenges and concerns. And in 2014, my best friend took her own life, which was really, really difficult for me. And then in 2015, that's when I kind of hit my version of rock bottom. I started withdrawing some from friends and family. Or when I was out and about and, you know, doing things, I was kind of high functioning, but I thought I was depressed. Or I knew I was depressed and didn't know what to call it, rather.
Yeah.
So that was really tough for me. And I even, you know, I wrote a book in 2011 about my career as a woman in music. I branded myself the hip hop professional. I started speaking at colleges and
it's a great name,
things.
By the way.
Thank you. So, you know, I started doing all that stuff, which was wonderful, but I still wasn't happy and I still don't think I found my purpose of where I should be. And so that's when in 2015 I contemplated taking my own life, and I counted up all the pills in my drawer, kind of planned out my funeral in my head of what it would be and how it would affect my family and my friends. And I ended up getting out of the house that night. Thank God I did not take the pills, but I came close and I got the help that I needed.
What made you, you know, a lot of people I'm sure can kind of relate to what you're saying, whether it's loss of family, friends, and their own struggles, and they make that decision to take their life. Mm-hmm. What was the reason to make you want to get help so quickly? How did you go about doing it, right?
So that night, I got out of the house. I was just, because I had these weird thoughts in my head telling me to kill myself. So these thoughts were racing and I couldn't control them. So that scared me.
Yeah.
So I got out of the house and started driving because I was like, at least if I get away from my bathroom and get away from the pills, then maybe I can figure this whole thing out. So I ran across a friend who saw me and knew something wasn't right. So she convinced me to call my sister because everyone, again, knows how close I am to my sister. So my sister encouraged me, to call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So I talked to them for about 15 to 20 minutes.
Wow.
And it was, you know, I think they talked me out of the immediate threat of harming myself. But I still wasn't quite sure that I was ready to go back to the house. So I texted my pastor at the time. And I'm not Catholic anymore, but I go to Ebenezer Baptist Church here in Atlanta. And my pastor said to me, he was like, I'll pray with you, but you got to go to the doctor. He was very matter of fact, like, you have to call your doctor and you need to go get help. So I called my doctor Monday morning and they referred me to a psychiatrist. And so I went and started on my antidepressants. And that kind of started my journey of getting back to feeling better.
You know, this proves, though, it kind of comes back to your childhood. Your friends were there when you needed them to be, right? And they weren't afraid to step in or to say something. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that one friend that ran into you.
Yeah, because she was like, you don't look like yourself. Like, what's going on?
I mean, that's unbelievable that she would just acknowledge that and then call
your
sister.
Yeah. And she made me call my sister. So
I think most people, too, when you hear or when you look at a lot of these studies, they want somebody to step in. They're looking for somebody. And sometimes those messages are ignored, right? So it's great to see that, you know, people are cognizant of this stuff sometimes and not afraid to step in and say something.
Exactly. And the issue is you can't be afraid, you know, to talk to people, to talk to your loved ones or family members. Because, you know, I talk to people with the work that I do now, and they've been in situations where they're like, I'd rather have my friend mad at me and alive.
100%.
Than not.
100%.
But the other side of that, too, is, you know, even if you talk to that person and they still decide to take their own life, you can't blame yourself. Because you just never know what's going through a person's 100%. Mind. And so, you know, grief and guilt is really tricky, and you have to be careful with it, that you don't allow yourself to just fall or succumb to that guilt so that it takes control of your life.
So you get the help that's needed, you start to take control, and you start to go through this process.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like this journey is what kind of has led you to kind of what you're doing now, which mm-hmm. has some of the greatest impact and purpose mm-hmm. at the moment. So mm-hmm. first you started with the Hip Hop Foundation, correct?
Yeah, it was called the Hip Hop Professional Foundation.
Okay. And that foundation's purpose, if you just kind of want to talk on
that. Sure, yeah. The foundation was built to provide opportunities and resources for underserved communities in youth empowerment, poverty, and mental health.
Okay, and then you start this, and it was 17?
Yeah, so 2016 I came up with, or the end of 2015 and the beginning of 2016, I came up with the term Silence of Shame. So Silence of Shame started as a quote-unquote movement under the Hip Hop Professional Foundation. So that really kind of became like our platform for mental health.
And this is also when you had a campaign that kind of took a life of its own and went viral.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, can you talk about that? Because yeah. I remember when you were starting it, and then yeah. the next day you see the press and I'm like, wow, that apparently there's a need for this.
Yeah.
And people are yearning for it.
So in 2017, I decided to come up with my own day. I said, you know what? I'm going to deem May 5th as National Silence of Shame Day. So we created this little graphic for social media. And it said like National Silence of Shame Day or something. And I said, I'm going to see if some of my like colleagues from music, any of the artists I work with or and everyday people would post on May 5th and see what comes back. We got 90 million impressions in one day.
Unbelievable.
Then we got featured in like Forbes and blackdoctors.org and Blavity and all types of, you know, online platforms. And so I was like, wait a minute. We got something here, to the point where like people are suffering and they need the help and they need to talk about it. And so that's kind of what started our trajectory in 2017. And then in 2018, we applied to the National Day Register, which like comes up with all these quote unquote days like National Popcorn Day,
yeah.
National Teachers Day, National This Day. And we got accepted.
It's amazing.
So like every day from now on, in addition to it being Cinco de Mayo, May 5th is National Silence of Shame Day.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
That's amazing. So now that Silence of Shame is kind of garnering a lot of traction
mm-hmm.
and people are taking notice, obviously, we see an issue in this country where mental illness, mental health is kind of overlooked sometimes. And I think kind of came in at the right time mm-hmm. when people needed it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do you think that people have embraced what you're doing so much? Because there are other causes, but really
sure.
nothing that I've seen that's kind of taken kind of in such a quick period of time,
mm-hmm.
the support and kind of embrace that people have given towards this.
Yeah, it really is, you know, astonishing to look at what we've been able to accomplish in a 2-year period with like no real funding, by the way, compared to most other
yeah.
larger organizations, right? We have had some funding, but not from a traditional sense of what most foundations have. And I think you mentioned this earlier, like fortunately, unfortunately, I came into the mental health field, if you will, at a time where it wasn't as popular. And then it was just like this pivot almost, and people just started opening up and sharing. And so now I don't like to say the popular thing to do, but it is being more normalized now, and people are sharing like everywhere you look, you know, some artist or athlete or, you know, business person is coming out and sharing, as well as everyday people on social media. And so, you know, I'd look at it as it was a blessing for me to be able to take my pain and to turn it into something that could be so positive for the community from a global perspective. And people are hurting. It's a lot going on out there. And having an organization like Silence of Shame, which is more for education and awareness, you know, we provide programs around that. And I even had people to tell me, like, it's not going to work. Education and awareness, nobody's going to fund you for that. But I'm like, it's so needed. Like, half of the battle when someone's sibling or spouse or loved one goes through something is they don't know how to care for that person. So you do have to create the awareness and you do have to create the education. And so it just started catching on. And we started getting a lot of people on the clinical side to support us, whether it was, you know, therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, as well as, you know, hospitals and institutions. And then me reaching back out into the entertainment side, getting artists to come out. You know, singer-songwriter Keri Hilson opened up on one of our panel discussions, the rapper David Banner, Big Crit, you know, different people like Big Sean have done drops for us. You know, it's just been very supportive. And everybody's going through something. You know, I tell people, we may not all have a mental illness, but we all have mental health, just like we have physical health. And it could affect your physical health, just like the stress was starting to really take a turn on the physical side for me. And I think it was all as a result of my depression when I was still at the record company in 2009. And so what we're trying to do now is really just tell that story and get people to be okay with not being okay and starting to open up. And so now, because most of the work that we've done with the foundation has been around mental health, we decided to rename the foundation and rebrand everything under Silence the Shame. So we'll still deal with poverty and do our no reservations needed thing that we do at the Atlanta Mission and other outreach within the homeless community. But it's all about silencing the shame around mental health, poverty, and youth empowerment. You know, those, you know, youth that come from disenfranchised areas and communities that need the help.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really impactful and important what you said, that we may not all suffer from a mental illness, but we all have mental health.
Everybody.
And when you look at a lot of these studies, when people either develop anxiety, depression, or anything along these lines, the number one indicator or the number one factor is always stress.
Yes.
And if you can show me a person on average that doesn't incorporate some stress at different mm-hmm. levels in their life, you'd mm-hmm. be foolish.
Absolutely. And it's because we don't have healthy coping mechanisms, right, to deal with that stress or to handle that stress.
Yeah. And that's why I think education, like you're saying, on the matter is everything.
And that's why when people are stressed out, they turn to drugs and alcohol, right? And they start self-medicating. Which, if you already have sort of chemical imbalance or a genetic history of mental illness in your family, those substances and the abuse of those substances could then trigger, you know, those illnesses at some point.
So you've had quite an eclectic life of unbelievable experiences, challenges, ups and downs. Mm-hmm. When you look back at the music and you look back at what you're doing now, I know they all kind of hold a certain place in the life. Which one do you think has created more of an impact on you personally or brought you greater kind of gratitude or mm-hmm. kind of passion?
So it's a great question. I have been struggling the last few years of finding my place now, right? Going from music industry veteran to now mental health advocate. And I was trying to figure out like, wow, what does this look like or what does it mean for my legacy, right? Am I just throwing away this wonderful, wonderful career that I've been afforded my entire life in entertainment, and now I'm doing something that's a little less, what's the word? I don't know, glorified, if you will, in society. And so a friend of mine, he's also my co-host, his name is Free the Vision. He was like, it's not two separate legacies. He was like, it's one legacy. And it took somebody younger than me just looking at my life and my career saying, you're still Shanti Das, period. So you can still be proud of what you've done in music and be just as proud as what you're doing now. I love and value everything I've done in music. But to now know that I'm affecting humans, right, no matter what race, color, creed you are, on such a humbling level, something that can be so devastating and tragic for some families, and knowing that I'm having a positive impact, or that my organization and my staff is having a positive impact for people that are really struggling with life experiences is pretty special. And you know, a lot of the work we do is in the Atlanta community. We produce events across the nation. I've done work with the NFL Players Association. I've spoken at the NBA. You know, I spoke last year at a hip hop conference in Amsterdam, speaking this fall in Ireland. I'm ready to take this show on the road for mental health globally. I want to be a global ambassador for mental health and speak around the country. It was very humbling for me a couple of months ago. I'm on Instagram and I saw that a small mental health organization in Kenya, in Africa, started using my hashtag.
Wow.
And started reposting some of my stuff. And it literally brought me to tears because mental health in a lot of other countries is not addressed the same way it is in the States and in some European countries and, you know, outside of the U.S. and Europe. And so it was very humbling to see someone in Kenya and Africa seeing the positivity, right, and the importance in the work that we're doing. So,
you know, it's crazy. I didn't think about this until, like, we're talking now and it just pops up in my head. But you talk about legacy, you talk about all these things. What's interesting is you've kind of had one thing in common this whole time, which is the power of words, mm-hmm. right? The power of the music that you were helping put out, mm-hmm. and then the power of what you're speaking in this arena to mm-hmm. affecting others. So mm-hmm. it's amazing how your words have kind of transcended mm-hmm. different verticals, races, mm-hmm. religions, and impacted people on a human level that most people honestly never had the opportunity to do.
Yeah.
Which is pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm very grateful. And one of my passions is traveling. Like, you know, I used to be into shopping, you know, like a lot of ladies love purses and bags and stuff, but I'm into more experiences now. And to be able to see the world, I think, is the greatest gift of all. It's a big old world out there, and some of us are afraid to go out and experience it. And if music and mental health can be the driving force for me to see the world, then I'm ready.
Yeah.
Book my flight, pack my bag, let's go.
So with that being said, what is next for Silence the Shame? What is next for yourself?
So we are coming up on May, which is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we will be doing our national text-a-thon. It's kind of like the Super Bowl for us. It's our opportunity to raise funding so that we can hopefully, you know, continue to do more programs. We're starting to offer mental health first aid training, which is great. We're putting together some teen mental health forums that we want to take around the country because we see a lot of our teens struggling with depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation. So we want to do more work around there. We also do self-care Saturdays every other Saturday in Atlanta, but I like to see that taking into other cities. And what that is it's a 1 hour activity for you to get out and either exercise. We do Zumba classes. Sometimes we do hip hop yoga or regular yoga. We do meditation, mindfulness classes. So encouraging people to incorporate a really great self-care regimen into their daily lives. We are continuing our podcast, starting to beef up some of our programming. We now offer our podcast every other Wednesday, so being able to be consistent in the marketplace for that. Also shooting additional content. We just received a grant from the AIDS Health Foundation, so we're now going to be doing community conversations, taking a look at the double stigma of mental health and HIV in the urban community. Just, you know, a plethora of stuff.
So just a little bit going on.
Just a little bit. Yeah, but we're excited. We hope you guys will support us on our fundraising efforts. If you would love to donate to the organization, you can text the word SILENCE to 707-070. Also, we're revamping our website because with us rebranding, we're building out the new website for Silence to Shame and all of our socials. But, you know, follow us on Instagram at Silence to Shame. On Facebook, we're at Silence TH Shame. We post a lot of helpful information and articles if you or someone that you know is experiencing, you know, some mental health challenges. But we want to continue just kind of, you know, being at the forefront of what's going on with this conversation because it really is about wellness. You know, you find a lot of larger corporations are now hiring, you know, wellness directors.
Yeah,
absolutely. We've had conversations with other brands. You know, I really want to do some cool stuff in entertainment and sports around mental health or around wellness, if you will. Yeah. And so I'm hoping to create some unique opportunities with pop culture and fashion and artists and so forth.
Very cool.
Around wellness, so.
Very cool. So yeah. Doing epic things on many levels.
I hope so.
So for everybody really. That kind of listens today or checks out this podcast, what is the one thing if they kind of walk away with, what is the one piece of information or advice that you would give somebody listening?
Wow. Knowledge is power. And that's what's so key to what's going on around mental health, emotional health and wellness, whatever you want to call it. The more you know, the better you can help yourself and people around you. You know, I think we all have family members that have experienced mental illness or challenges, and we don't know what we don't know. And you cannot help yourself and you cannot help that family member. So I say all that to say, get educated, get informed. And, you know, again, even if it's not around mental illness, you still, if you want that job, learn about the job, do the research, get informed, you know, become aware, educate yourself about that field that you're trying to go into. Knowledge is still power.
Well, Shanti, I just want to thank you for coming in today. I love what you're doing. I think it's absolutely amazing. And honestly,
kudos to you.
I appreciate
it. And your agency doing some awesome work. Listen, hopefully we can do some stuff on wellness together. That'd
absolutely.
Be really cool.
I'm a big fan of what you're doing. And I think, honestly, what you've accomplished in 2 years is a testament to what you've put in. and Thank that you. There's a need for it. So I hope everybody, you know, listens, supports this, embraces this, or even does something in their city that they could do to kind of educate
sure.
people. So like you said, knowledge is power. I think that's wonderful. And I don't care what area of life. I think that that's
Period.
Goes across all verticals.
We
so.
Have to educate ourselves. And don't just take what you read on Google as gospel. As yeah. much as I love Google and I think it's a wonderful resource, you know, get your hands dirty. Get out there and figure it out on your own sometimes.
All right. Well, thank you for coming in today, Shanti.
Appreciate
you. And excited for people to hear this.
Oh, and you can follow me on my personal Instagram page at ShantiDoss404. I am an author of 2 books, The Hip Hop Professional, as well as my own book, which I forgot to mention, called Silencing My Shame. And it takes you more through my journey of my dad taking his own life, which we didn't really talk about that. But if you want to know more about that side of my journey, you can get my book. Silencing My Shame.
I love it. Support people. Support.
Yes.
Thanks, Shanti.
Thanks.
All right. Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.